coming up on Weekend America.
Being a doctor means giving tender, loving care. Being an ER doctor means not always getting that in return.
Many patients who come into the emergency room are difficult. They're intoxicated, they're belligerent, they're angry, and so things happen and you just sort of have to roll with it.
A weekend in the ER. I'm John Moe. Also this hour, Barack Obama is many things: Democrat, Hawaii native, White Sox fan, and poetry enthusiast.
If you have a president who reads poetry, there's hope, because poetry tries to tell the truth.
Obama's favorite poet talks about what to expect from the next president. And why the future of music isn't on stage or in the studio.
I'm looking forward to the day when some kid does a remix in his bedroom and puts it online and it's a number one hit, which I'm sure we're, you know, very close to.
Take a listen to the future of music and why it sounds more like the past than you might think. Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. A new year has begun. And I know that I make a lot of jokes on this show, and some of them are kind of cynical, and the economy has given us plenty of reasons to be cynical, but let's think about this new year in a new way. It's a blank piece of paper waiting to be written on. It's waking up to a fresh layer of snow, which is not hard to imagine here in St. Paul. Let's get out our sleds and go out into this 2009. That's what we're doing this hour. We'll visit with Derek Walcott. He's Barack Obama's favorite poet. His words inspire the next president. We'll get Derek Walcott's take on the year to come. Plus, a conversation with New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik. He's been researching 19th century America and says that whole history comes around again thing, yeah, it's happening. Look, I'm not saying 2009 will be great or horrible, but it will be an adventure. What are you looking forward to in 2009?
Music's got to improve, and quickly.
Animal Collective's new album is coming out, and they're going on tour.
Airplane tickets are too expensive, and that's got to go down.
I'm going to Greece this summer.
And I'm looking forward to getting a raise in 2009.
I'm looking forward to getting married and starting nursing school.
I'd like to start writing a book.
This summer, I'm going to hike the Tahoe Rim Trail.
Barack's first term as president. It'd be interesting to see how he can fix the economy and just see how his cabinet's put together and see how well he sticks with his campaign promises.
Those voices came from San Francisco, Chicago, and Fairbanks, Alaska. Many of us are spending this weekend thinking about our own plans for the upcoming year, our hopes, our expectations. Anne Shotwell knows a lot about planning, though for her, it's more week to week. She runs a hot meal program 3 Wednesday nights a month out of Morningstar Baptist Church on Cleveland's East Side. It's a low-income neighborhood hit hard by foreclosures. 150 people or more show up for the meal, and Mrs. Shotwell gets most of the food for it by shopping at Cleveland's food bank. Morningstar Baptist is only one of several hunger centers to be set up recently in the Cleveland area. The city's food bank has seen a 23% increase in the amount of food they distributed last year over the year before. At the same time, food donations from manufacturers are down, which is part of a nationwide trend. We reached Anne Shotwell recently during a shopping trip to the Cleveland food bank. I asked her what goes into planning a free meal for so many people.
I feed weekly. And I usually do this week for next week. That's how I have to plan it. I don't have a lot of storage place, so I don't get to store up weeks or months supply of anything. I try to keep my inventory moving, and I basically do green beans, corn, potatoes, chicken, and very seldom we have enough to serve. Never steaks. We don't do that. But every now and then, I can hoard up enough of beef to do a beef dinner.
Who traditionally shows up at your Wednesday dinner?
I remember 5 or 6 years ago when we first started the program at my church. You could look for not really the homeless people, but the men that were not working or chose not to work, whichever, had very few teenagers because of the stigma that they put on eating at what they would call charity. I now have mothers feeding babies and teenagers. And my biggest role right now, and I can understand why, being a senior myself and on a limited budget, we have seniors now that I never would have thought would have come to eat. So the need, the faces have completely changed from when I started this program 5.5 years ago. I've seen it have gone the whole gamut, from men in the street or women in the street that didn't have a home to eat out of, to now children coming in with their parents because that's basically their solid meal. And that's why I don't serve hot dogs and hamburgers.
You don't?
No, because they're not full. You know, I do a full course meal. I use hot dogs and hamburgers for a backup. Should I run out or not able to serve gift seconds, then I can pull out a hamburger or a hot dog. No one leaves hungry. Hmm. So that was that's my motto with feeding.
What do you hope happens this year, this coming year, as a new administration goes into Washington? What's your hope for the future?
My hope for particularly the food of people, number one, is that I would like to be able to go shopping and have enough to not have to measure it out to the people. That bothers me, to have to give somebody one piece of chicken when most people can eat two. So that's what I'm hoping, is that our new president will at least, or it's a budget that they're getting ready to come into, whatever they're going to do, would look at hunger, because the face of hunger has changed. And I've watched it change from people in the street to babies in carriages, and it's just that bad.
Mrs. Ann Shotwell in Cleveland, Ohio, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can see pictures of Ann Shotwell and the food bank at weekendamerica.org. The new year brings a new president, of course, and the prospect of change to the U.S. healthcare system. Reformers want more people to have affordable care and health insurance. That would mean fewer people relying on emergency rooms as their primary source of medical care. Massachusetts isn't waiting for the rest of the country on this issue, however. They're already pursuing universal health care for all residents. Hasn't been fully implemented yet, but ERs there are already changing how they deal with patients with chronic conditions. Reporter Kurt Nickisch spent a Friday night following an ER doctor at Mass General Hospital.
It's 7 p.m. Dr. Jennifer Millen is tending to a Haitian woman about 60 years old. The woman's bony shoulders stick out from her hospital gown. Her legs are swollen like pickles. Her family is bedside, translating the Haitian Creole.
She was having chest pain yesterday. She's been having it all the time.
Millen's never seen this patient before. She probably never will again. So she has to start from scratch, jotting down the labels of the 5 bottles of meds the woman brought with.
No, and she's been taking them all? Did she miss any medications today?
No, she took them this morning.
She did? Can you just make sure? Can you ask? Yeah, you definitely took them this morning?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She miss any yesterday?
Millen is stumped. The patient's history is not adding up. That's typical here in the acute section of Mass General's ER, where the sickest patients come. On a Friday night, Millen sees many people who come in with serious chronic problems but couldn't reach their primary doctors on the weekend.
Some of the things we can't really do in the emergency room are manage long-term problems like high blood pressure or diabetes. That's a little frustrating sometimes.
Millen's job is not to heal patients, but to stabilize them and move them on for further care. It sounds simple, but sometimes this means figuring out tough cases with very little information. Her sickest patient tonight is an elderly man who's on a ventilator after a heart attack. The EMTs who responded had to give him drugs to be able to get a tube down his throat.
So he's paralyzed and sedated and completely non-responsive at this point. Sad. We're not sure what, we're really not sure what happened.
And then there are patients who are more than happy to talk, like this woman who came in complaining of shortness of breath.
Was it a rough ride with EMS?
Well, I'll say this is the smoothest ride that I've had in 27 years.
All right.
Of coming in here.
By 9 p.m., Millen is handling at least a half dozen patients at the same time, and this is a relatively quiet weekend night. Patient load is supposed to be lighter under Massachusetts universal health care law. The idea is that if people have insurance and therefore primary care, chronic health problems won't turn into emergencies as often. But so far, patient volume is as heavy as ever.
I usually eat when I can. You should never know when you're going to get a chance to eat. When I walk by a bathroom and I have a second, I just pop in. I'm like, may as well go. Actually, some of the residents have had kidney stones because they get dehydrated and they can't go to the bathroom, and it's not good. It's not good.
Millen updates digital records at a computer while she snacks, and it's there that she gets the chest X-ray back from her Haitian patient.
I'm going to throw the ultrasound on. Oh, my gosh. That's huge.
For aspiration.
There's a gray ball as big as a cantaloupe inside the woman's rib cage. It's her heart, the biggest heart Millen's ever seen. It's clear the woman has had high blood pressure for decades, but it still doesn't explain why she had to come into the ER now. Millen sends off for the woman's records from another Boston hospital, the last to treat her.
Sometimes there's just not enough information. I mean, we can't do everything in the emergency room. Even sometimes with all the testing in the world, you still can't figure out what it is. And that's when you really need someone to follow the patient and try different things and see what works and what doesn't.
I think that's what we were looking for.
It took a couple of hours, thanks to federal confidentiality rules. But the other hospital has faxed over the records for the Haitian patient.
Wow. Oh my gosh, she's like taking like 4 medications. She's supposed to be on 20.
That explains a lot. The records help Millen figure what to do. By midnight, the woman's admitted to another part of the hospital where she'll get the right drugs to get her blood pressure back to normal. When Millen leaves around 1 in the morning, her job is over. It's Saturday now. She throws a coat over her scrubs and walks home about a mile to unwind. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Abe Lincoln and Charles Darwin aren't around to share their thoughts on what 2009 will be like, but writer Adam Gopnik is here, and he's been researching those other guys quite a lot. Next on Weekend America. from American Public Media. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We're focused on 2009 this weekend, what the new year will be. But, you know, let's be honest. The only way to really examine where we're going is to look at where we've been. The future is only a result of all the decisions that have been made in the past leading up to this point. This isn't the first recession we've ever had. After all, it's happened before. And as bleak and scary as tough times can be, there is some comfort, maybe not much, but some, in knowing that other travelers have been down this road. New Yorker magazine writer Adam Gopnik has been spending a lot of time thinking about the 19th century lately. At the end of this month, his new book, Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life, will be published. Adam Gopnik says he was intrigued by what Lincoln and Darwin had in common.
They share exactly the same birthdate. They were both born on February 12, 1809. I thought that there might be something to say about the origins of what to call it, modern consciousness, the way we live now, liberal civilization, in their lifetimes, and particularly in the way that they changed our language and our expectations. So I ended up writing a book sort of not knowing necessarily where the book was going to go when I began it, that ended up being very much about the birth of a new kind of liberal eloquence, and particularly about the beginnings of a kind of eloquence of explanation, an eloquence of argument instead of an eloquence of uplift. And I hope, though I couldn't have planned it and I didn't see it coming, that that idea that there's a kind of eloquence of explanation might be one of the good things that Barack Obama brings to America.
He's an eloquent speaker.
He's an eloquent speaker, of course. Everybody sees that. But for me, the most moving speech he made in the campaign was the speech he made about race in Philadelphia. Because the eloquence there wasn't the eloquence of uplift. It was exactly the eloquence of explanation. He took a very hard, thorny subject, why it is, despite Jeremiah Wright's melodrama and exaggeration, he still had a sort of residual respect for him, that you had to separate out a certain kind of anger from its history. You could reject it, but you could still understand it. And similarly, you could understand a similar kind of anger on the part of white working class people and so on. A very complicated, subtle historical argument he was making, and yet he made it in terms that were broadly understood, widely available. And that side of Obama's eloquence is much more appealing and interesting to me than his ability to charge up a stadium full of 80,000 people, because a lot of second-rate people have been able to do that. And I think also that if there's a kind of American liberal tradition or people who believe in democratic civilization, I think if there is a tradition of that kind of liberal eloquence, it's exactly that tradition, the tradition of Darwin, the tradition of making a very complicated scientific argument plain in a popular book. The tradition of Lincoln, the tradition of making very complicated arguments about equality, democracy, union, war, compact and eloquent and available. If we see in 2009 a revival of that kind of eloquence, the eloquence of explanation and argument, it will be a very good year.
Well, let's talk about the economic situation, because there are shadows of that from the 19th century as well. After immersing yourself in the 19th century to research and write about Darwin and Lincoln, what can you tell us, and how has that affected how you look at the situation today?
Well, if I say, you know, we'll have the eloquence of explanation, but oy, the things we're going to have to explain. You know, in the 19th century, they called what we call recessions, revulsions, that there was these sudden kind of revulsions of the market. And they are like that. And suddenly, everything we believed 6 months ago was true turns out to be false. And just as at the time when you're on the height of the boom, you think it's going to go on forever, when you get to the bottom of it, you think we'll never recover. And I think that there's a certain kind of consoling wisdom in being able to look back and say, this has been the pattern of capitalist society as long as we've had it. It's a fantastic engine of growth, and the engine always burns out. Not most of the time, not often. This isn't the first time or the second time or the third time we've been through this cycle. It's more like the 10th or 11th or 15th time. One of the things that the eloquence of explanation can give you is the possibility of calm, the possibility of proportion, the possibility of perspective. That was clearly one of the things that Lincoln was very good at during the Civil War, not only leading what was, to that point, a uniquely murderous war, but also being able to say, this is what this war is about. We are suffering. We're living in a republic of suffering. But the goal, the end, the purpose is as clear to us as the panic and the pain is clear to us. That's what the Gettysburg Address is all about. And my hope would be that exactly that eloquence of explanation would help, if not to solve the problem immediately, at least to ease the panic that we all feel.
Do you have any resolutions for the new year?
One resolution I have for the new year is to try, this is embarrassing but true, is to try and meditate. And as a consequence of that, I am also determined to stay off the internet for days at a time, because I do think that the internet has become an addiction for so many of us. It was the absurdity of the weeks before the election, which I'm sure you remember,
yes,
when we were consulting Real Clear Politics every 15 minutes. And there was no useful information that we gained by that act. It was simply a form of a massive national nervous tick. And I think as each of us begins to disengage a little bit from that particular kind of preoccupation, we'll feel like the people in the Matrix when they're pulled out of their wombs. Remember that?
Yes,
and the wires are pulled out of
right.
the pods. And I think that unplug your neighbor is a decent resolution for the coming year.
You know,
unplug yourself and then unplug your neighbor.
I started that like 2 days ago because it's as if I scraped bottom. My wife and I were like sitting with two different laptops in the same room.
Exactly.
And we said, this can't be right. And so we started putting them away at like 7 o'clock at night. We weren't allowed to touch them till morning. And I found that I got tired much earlier in the night and got more sleep.
That is so funny. We have had exactly the same experience.
I said,
I am not going to go online between dinner time and the next morning. There's nothing to find. There will be nothing gained. Any email that arrives can easily wait until the next day. And nothing is lost by this. And exactly as you say, it's essentially an little insomnia generator. It's like the aliens,
right,
as a joke. And I said, let's give them those things and then they'll never sleep.
Right. We'll just pump enough into your brain to keep you awake, but not enough to really educate you in any meaningful way.
Maybe we are the twin head of a transformation, but we made exactly the same resolution and I've been sleeping nights because of it.
New Yorker magazine writer Adam Gopnik's latest book is Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life. The subtitle there, he tells me, is tongue-in-cheek. That comes out later this month. If you're looking for an interesting book about parenting and you don't want to go online to read things, check out Adam's 2000 book, Paris to the Moon. A warning, though, it will make you want to move to France.
Supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Barack Obama is a big fan of poetry. He's been spotted carrying around a book by the poet Derek Walcott. So, what does Derek Walcott think of all that, and what it means to America? Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. A couple of weeks ago, in his weekly radio and YouTube address, President-elect Barack Obama talked about the role science would play in his presidency. Obama said his administration would seek to ensure that facts and evidence reported by scientists are never twisted or obscured by politics or ideology. That's a stance dear to the heart of author and neurologist Oliver Sacks. As part of our series Conversations with America, we asked Sacks if he had memories of times of transition, like the one we're in between presidents.
I arrived in America in a similar transition period in November of 1960. Kennedy had been elected and was due to take office in a few weeks' time. I'd loved Westerns. I loved Ansel Adams photos, and one of the great attractions of America for me was the feeling of great open spaces and mountains and oceans and forests. But I think one of the things which brought me to America 50 years ago was the notion of a very diverse society and a relatively open one. In England, you are classified the moment you open your mouth. Your accent and your intonation, they can't be disguised. You are instantly classified and categorized. If you're middle class, as I am, you expect to be despised by the upper class and disliked by the lower class. Kennedy, in his inaugural, in his beautiful speech, was so clear about the separation of church and state. I mean, I have a Bible by my bedside. I love the Bible. I love Bible stories. Science is not the whole of life, but they need to be kept separate. There are a lot of books in this apartment. All the books we're facing are biology or natural history books at the moment, and very prominent to the left, in those pink covers, are the collected works of Darwin. I first read some of his botanical books when I was 13 or 14. I go back to him again and again. I love this vision of the world, which is one of change and evolution and adventure and depth, of enormous historical depth. I'm wearing a Darwin T-shirt at the moment. This Darwin T-shirt contains a reproduction of the Tree of Life as he first sketched it in 1837 in one of his notebooks. And as he was escaping from the notion of special creation to the vision of evolution. My mother was a comparative anatomist, you know, and sometimes when we had a fish, she would point out the similarities between fish anatomy and human anatomy, how the little bones in the ear were developed from the jaws of fish. And so the notion of the continuity and evolution of life is a great wonder and delight to me. It excites me to think that I and some of my organs and my DNA are millions and billions of years old. I've been very disturbed at the dismissal of reports on global warming, at the removal of caps on arsenic and lead and mercury, and at the general sort of environmental degradation and exploitation which has been going on. If I had a chance to talk to President Obama, I would say that my special concerns were to do with the downgrading and devaluation and dismissal of science over the last 8 years. I'm a doctor, I'm a neurologist. I see patients with degenerative nerve disease, people with Alzheimer's, with Parkinson's, who are losing their nerve cells. I would show him some of my patients with Parkinson's disease, especially the younger ones in the 30s and 40s, whose potential for life, for a productive and joyful life, is being blighted by the holding back of therapies which could be so important for them. The only possibility of getting any real regeneration in the nervous system, the only real therapeutic chance for them, the radical therapeutic hope, would come from the use of stem cells. But stem cell research has been virtually blocked in the last 8 years here. Please, Mr. Obama, unblock it.
Oliver Sacks is a professor of clinical neurology and clinical psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center. His latest book is Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. President-elect Barack Obama has a lot of writers very excited about the next 4 to 8 years. Obama will have a poet at his inauguration, not the first to do so, but he's also said he's going to host poetry readings at the White House. He's even quoted poetry on the campaign trail. Here's part of a speech he gave back on Super Tuesday.
Change will not come if we wait for some other person or if we wait for some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for.
That last line is from June Jordan's poem for South African women. Nobel laureate Derek Walcott has been thinking about what it means to have a president who is versed in verse. And Walcott talked with Weekend America's Larissa Anderson.
A few days after the election, poet and playwright Derek Walcott saw a picture in the paper of Barack Obama carrying around a copy of Walcott's collected poems. Walcott says he was flattered.
But for me, what that means is nothing to do with me so much as the fact if you have a president who reads poetry, there's hope, because poetry tries to tell the truth.
Derek Walcott's from St. Lucia, an island that used to belong to the British Empire. His grandfather was a white plantation owner from Barbados. His grandmothers were descended from slaves. A lot of his writing is about being caught between cultures. Walcott says it's good for people in power to read poetry because, let's face it, human beings are complex, we're contradictory, and poetry can capture that. Like in Langston Hughes' poem, Theme for English B, when the black student writes to his white teacher, "Sometimes perhaps you don't want to be a part of me, nor do I often want to be a part of you, but we are. That's true." Walcott likes the idea of a president who reads poetry and thinks about this kind of truth. Someone who can see beyond the act of political posturing.
There's a deeper truth in the contradictions that exist in poetry than there is in foreign policy. Foreign policy changes with generations. One generation, you're the enemy of Japan. The next one, you're the friend of Germany. And so it's never stable. Who are our enemies and when are they our enemies? You can't deal with those lies. There's a deeper truth in there.
For Walcott, politics and poetry make a natural pair. He wrote his latest poem for Obama. The title, 40 Acres, refers to the 40 acres and a mule offered to slaves after emancipation. That offer was revoked, and the phrase came to represent a broken promise of equality.
40 acres to Barack Obama. Out of the turmoil emerges one emblem, an engraving. A young Negro at dawn in straw hat and overalls, an emblem of impossible prophecy. A crowd dividing like the furrow which a mule has plowed, parting for their president. A field of snow-flecked cotton, 40 acres wide, of crows with predictable omens that the young plowman ignores for his unforgotten cotton-haired ancestors, while lined on one branch is a tense court of bespectacled owls, and on the field's receding rim a gesticulating scarecrow stamping with rage at him. The small plow continues on this lined page beyond the moaning ground, the lynching tree, the tornado's black vengeance, and the young plowman feels the change in his veins, heart, muscles, tendons, till the land lies open like a flag as dawn's shore light streaks the field and furrows wait for the sower. The way I knew it was going to perhaps finish itself was finding the rhyme, which sometimes happens in a poem, like crowd and plowed. Once that happened, I saw the furrow that the plow made, the same thing as if, say, a limousine were going through a crowd, it would make a furrow of a kind, and the turnover of the dirt would be the separation of people before the president's car, which, of course, becomes a plow. So the idea of the design of the whole endeavor of the plowing becomes the endeavor of shaping the flag with all the states, Confederate and Union, together, led by this plowman who is the young president.
Walcott draws on the history of slavery in his poem for Obama. But he says Americans should not make a big deal of the fact that we elected our first black president.
What is there to celebrate to say that he is black and he's a president? The celebration is a contradiction of the belief. The statement is, all men are created equal, but when they become president, then you say, oh, we have a black president. How can they be equal if that's the case?
He says Americans should focus on the kind of person Obama is and celebrate that our next president is courteous, dignified, and he reads poetry. In St. Paul, I'm Larissa Anderson for Weekend America.
Derek Walcott's 40 Acres was commissioned by the Times of London for their November 6th Obama supplement. You can find a link to that poem and more at weekendamerica.org. Going out to eat this weekend? Don't be surprised if the restaurant manager seems just a little bit more cheerful. Restaurants have gotten something of a break lately. Cheaper gas has meant lower food prices, cheaper ingredients. But Moody's Investment Service reported last week that restaurants still have a tough road ahead of them in 2009 because it's so hard to refinance debt right now. Still, some ambitious restaurateurs are moving ahead with their dreams anyway. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Cast Iron Cafe has just opened for business. The tables are set. The glasses are on the table. Reporter Sarah Gustavus tells us what it's like to open a business in the midst of a vicious economic meltdown.
Tim Ackerman and Joey Minarsich, dressed in black pants and white chef coats, sit in a booth in the Cast Iron Cafe, the cozy comfort food diner they recently opened in Albuquerque. Many restaurants fail, even in the best of times, but they've opened a restaurant in the middle of a recession.
If we fail, people will obviously say you should have known it was going to be a failure, because look at the economy and look at the situation. And all I say to that is, okay, but if I succeed, you better be ready to call me a genius.
Right.
That's Tim. He and Joey think they have a recipe for surviving the downturn. First, the Cast Iron Cafe is affordable. It offers a local specialty of green chili and cornbread for $5. Joey predicts people will cut back on luxuries like vacations, but they won't stop going out to eat.
They may take a step down in price and start going to restaurants that are a little bit more inexpensive. They may even go out the same number of times. They just may, instead of going to the place where their guest check average is, say, $25, they might go to the place that it's $15 and even go the same number of times a week. Or there are people that just don't go out quite as often but still go to the same restaurant. So we thought we might be able to catch all those people if we played our cards right.
Joey and Tim decided to serve food with wide appeal. They crafted a menu of made-from-scratch comfort foods. And there's a chance their Tennessee pulled pork sandwich and Iowa chicken pot pie could soothe people's spirits during tough times.
I think I'd be a little bit dishonest if I said we sat down and said, we're going to give people what they need in this economy by putting out comfort food. But as it turns out, you know, that's kind of how it's going.
Hi, are there two in your party? Okay, right this way.
At a recent Sunday brunch, business is a little slow, but they are attracting repeat customers, like Mary Compton, who's here to meet a group of friends.
I've had the soup and salad, which was really good. It was really nice, and it, you know, was a reasonable price.
Mary says that despite the economy, she and her husband still eat out because it's convenient.
I think we've cut back a little, but so far, so good for us. We both still have our jobs. It's had a little effect. Maybe we don't splurge quite as much, but we still often go out like a couple, three times a week at least, just because of our schedules.
Customers are coming out, but the economy has affected the Cast Iron Cafe, and in a way that caught Tim and Joey completely off guard. They thought a recession would make it easy to attract employees, and they were right. They got over 150 calls on an ad that ran just one day in the local newspaper. But keeping them has been another story. Tim says they've gone through 30 employees in the first month.
I've worked in a lot of restaurants, and I've never seen anything like this. We've had like maybe 3 days fully staffed here because we've had so many people not coming in or having crisis or having to leave.
Tim believes the current economy is making life more chaotic for employees. He says people are struggling with stress from financial problems or even addiction. One young cook was living in his car, and Tim tried to help him out.
My big argument is always, okay, I understand you're having tough times. I'm willing to work with you on this, but I can tell you that losing your job is not going to help the situation.
The young man eventually stopped showing up to work. Tim and Joey aren't social workers. They're restaurant owners, and they need to keep the place going. So Tim and Joey have been working more than 100 hours a week, and they're spending more time working in the restaurant, chopping onions and making pot pie, than working on the restaurant, on marketing and fine-tuning their business model. Tim says that means putting future plans on hold to keep the green chili flowing today.
I think we are going to make it. And in some ways, that's just a matter of figuring out how to do it every single day.
For Weekend America, I'm Sarah Gustavus at the Cast Iron Cafe in Albuquerque.
Thank you. I've got a side of green chili with this biscuit here. Fire them now.
We all know that it snows a lot this time of year, but now we know it has been historically snowy this year. North Dakota had its snowiest month ever in December, and of any month, and that's a lot considering that it's North Dakota. There's winter fun to be had no matter where you are this weekend. Here's Jeannie Yandel.
Usually Texas doesn't experience naturally occurring ice, so it's understandable the town of Grapevine wants to celebrate frozen water at the appropriately named ice with an exclamation point. Sunny in 58, don't worry, they have cooling tents to peruse ice sculptures and ride down ice slides. Okay, ice on roads is no fun, but ice slides sound pretty great. Make like a penguin and go down on your belly. In 1851, Herman Melville wrote Moby Dick, and 157 years later, New Bedford, Massachusetts is doing a marathon reading of the novel. 38 and cloudy to spend 25 hours with Melville's descendants as they read the book aloud from beginning to end. 25 hours. Spoiler alert, Sigourney Weaver shoots Moby Dick out of the airlock at the end. The colder it gets, the less enjoyable it is to go outside. Denton, Nebraska challenges us to stop being such babies about the weather with their winter walkabout. 31 and sunny to wander the prairie and curse yourself for not wearing more long underwear. Denton, Nebraska, just blue skying here, but what about a winter hole up by the fire? A winter hot cocoa chug? No? For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Greg's new album is a hit, even though it isn't for sale in record stores. Well, actually, it kind of is, but you'd have to buy a few hundred different records and then combine them. We'll explain ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. One of the most talked about bands out there right now is Girl Talk. But Girl Talk is a pretty different kind of a band. To start out with, it's just one guy, Greg Gillis. Also, no instruments, just Greg and his laptop computer. And his albums aren't commercially available through the regular channels because the sounds in his songs are sampled without permission from other songs already out there. Songs you probably know. Hit songs. His latest release, Feed the Animals, has over 300 samples on it. Here's one of the tracks. It's called No Pause.
The rhythm the rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard drama, where you never been, I'm in. Do what styling.
Greg Gillis, a.k.a. Girl Talk, joins us now from Pittsburgh. Hello, Greg.
Hey, how's it going?
So, Greg, just walking through that track, and I have the benefit of notes here. We heard Faith Evans, Tom Tom Club, Missy Elliott, New Shoes with I Can't Wait, Kid and Play, Heart, Public Enemy, Africa Bambaataa. There was a lot of other things in there. Are you trying when you mix these tracks to see like how far you can range, or are you just trying to find good sounds to drop in?
I could make an album that would be totally unlistenable and would have, you know, five times the amount of samples as that, and it would include Beethoven and country music and whatever. And I mean, I'm down with all forms of music. But for this, it's like it's all about walking the line between having something that's somewhat experimental and progressive structurally, but still just accessible and listenable. So with these samples, you know, I'm kind of a pop fiend. I like a lot of pop music, and I like to sample stuff that people are familiar with, whether they like it, hate it, just to have that kind of emotional, nostalgic connection to a lot of these songs.
When did you become a performer? When did you say, I'm going to start making the music, or at least presenting the music in a new way? When did it go from being a fan to being an artist?
That was when I was 14 or 15, and that's when I started my first band. So a few of my friends got into the scene as well with me, and we would go out and see a lot of crazy underground acts in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, you know, we started performing out ourselves. And back then, you know, one of the interests was just to see how far we could push performance. It was borderline performance art. So, you know, we'd have shows where we'd have 30 CD players on stage just playing skipping CDs, and we would be smashing computers, and it would last 5 minutes, and that would be our set.
And then where did the current approach come from, and when did that start?
I think, you know, it all evolved from the early days. It was always something where a lot of the people who were doing live electronic music back then, I felt it was really boring, and I thought it was interesting, and I was conceptually into the idea of someone sitting there on stage staring into a computer and me paying $5 to watch that. But on an entertainment level, I was always kind of let down. So, you know, when I started doing Girl Talk, I knew it was going to be me in a computer doing live sound processing and collage. I just really wanted to make it entertaining. And I was playing with a lot of live bands, and it was the sort of situation where there'd be 15 people there. And if you just stare there looking at your computer, everyone's going to be talking to each other. No one's even going to realize you're playing. So I always made a point to put on a performance and kind of get in the crowd and try to stir it up. And within the underground scene that I came from, it was almost like, you know, remixing pop wasn't the norm. It was a different scene. So I was almost trying to challenge people with this idea of pop. And along with that, I wanted the performances to be like pop. I wanted to be entertainment. And then from there, you know, just kept putting out albums and touring and kind of fine-tuning the live show. And, you know, 6 years later, people eventually started to catch on a little bit. And then the shows stopped being confrontational, more celebratory. And people started to actually, instead of me screaming at people to dance, you know, the fans are screaming at me to keep going. So it just kind of faded into, like, you know, the dream faded into reality over the course of a few years.
So let's take a listen to another track from Girl Talk. Let's do number 7 here. And this is a track called Like This. And Greg, as we listen to this, let's talk about why you chose to put some of these things next to each other.
There's the idea of you can layer a drum beat, melody, and vocals, and I didn't want to overdo that, even though that's the center of the album. So there's many segments that are just kind of focused around percussion and cutting up things and kind of getting out of that rhythm of just having simply, like, just layered elements. And like the segment right after the Ghetto Superstar is a good example of that coming up right here.
Diana Ross.
Yeah, so this is a segment where, you know, I tried my best to have as much coming in and out as possible. There could be like 10 to 20 sources within 10 seconds, but not make it cluttered. You know, if you're just listening casually, it just flows. But if you want to sit there and piece it apart, it's very involved.
You're sort of an encyclopedia of pop music. You automatically are an authority, Greg, on what is popular. So tell us, as we head into 2009, what are we going to be listening to? What's going to be that top 40 song stuck in our head all year? What's it going to sound like?
Or we're losing the physicality with a lot of CDs, but people are becoming so interactive with the music via the internet. So I think, you know, I'm excited to see what happens. People, kids just, the learning curve just gets demolished. You know, people learn to pick up the software, young kids, and then the actual equipment is geared more towards them. So I think there'll be a lot of bedroom producers making it big very soon. I'm looking forward to the day when some kid does a remix in his bedroom and puts it online and it's a number one hit, which I'm sure we're, you know, very close to.
Any moment now. All right, Greg, thank you so much for your time.
Cool. It was nice chatting.
That was Greg Gillis, also known as Girl Talk. You can download his album, Feed the Animals, for whatever price you feel is right from his MySpace page. You can find that link at weekendamerica.org. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Larissa Anderson, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, who resolves to bike faster in 2009. He should have plenty of opportunities as he bikes almost constantly. Desiree Cooper resolves to make more time for creativity. We're also produced by Hillary Frank, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, Ocean Kalen, Sasha Oslanian resolving to follow through on good intentions, Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim, Mark Sanchez, and Chris Wieg. Groove is in the heart of Chris Wieg, and all of us, really. Our theme music, which is not this, but something else we often play, was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from weekendamerica.org. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for sweet reminiscences.
What I decided was that I would never have a favorite song and that instead I would hate all music forever.
You know, I don't like Hall & Oates anymore. That's how much I did not enjoy that situation.
We're making new memories, so you can go ahead and forget those old ones. Join us for the next Weekend America.